United States v. Allen. Mr. Michelle?
Michael, Your Honor.
Michael. I'm sorry. I've mispronounced that before when you've been here. Pretty consistent on mispronouncing it.
Back home when I made a tackle when I was in high school, they said tackle by Michelle. You know, I need to change it to Jones.
I apologize, but we're glad to have you here again and look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge King, may it please the court. My name is Aaron Michael. I am here on behalf of Raymont Allen, who was tried and convicted in the Western District of North Carolina for participating in a drug conspiracy involving crack. Three issues are raised on appeal. I believe that the parties are in agreement as to one of the issues, which is the issue of the retroactive application of the change in law about the statutory minimums applicable to Mr. Allen. Therefore, I would expect that this court will be sending it back for resentencing on that issue.
The government agrees with you to go back on that.
I believe so, Your Honor.
But you'd rather get the whole thing thrown out by saying there isn't any evidence. Then that would be moot, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the two issues are, one, whether or not there's any connection between the conspiracy alleged and proven, as far as I could tell, and Mr. Allen's alleged conduct that goes to the sufficiency of the evidence against him of being involved in the conspiracy. And the second issue is this issue of the witnesses that the government used, the benefits that they apparently were receiving, and that defense counsel at the trial was not permitted to fully explore or to explain to the jury, which I believe denied Mr. Allen a fair trial. But the big issue is the nature of the allegation being that there's this conspiracy in the hill in Marion, in the mountains of Western North Carolina. Evidence over 3 days, as the trial judge pointed out, involving that conspiracy in this location, both as to the participants in on the hill who were distributing it on the streets, the people they got their supply from, and the people that those people got their supply from. And they had a successful investigation, prosecution, got all those people to plead guilty, and then they go after Mr. Allen on two transactions from May 17th and 18th, 2010, one and a half ounce of alleged crack, and on the next day, 2 ounces of alleged crack. And the only witnesses to this are the two alleged co-conspirators who testified that these transactions took place. And while one of the witnesses was cooperating at the time with authorities in the investigation, and they were taking measures to keep track of what was going on, none of this, there was nothing to corroborate what this witness, Ms. Anderson, was saying about what she was doing, about what her boyfriend was doing. And so the evidence as to what happened on May 17th and May 18th was weak. And
what about the quantity, though, involved on back-to-back days? It seems to me that that's your weak spot, the fact you have back-to-back days and that you have a lot of hits of crack cocaine, or whatever the term is, individual rocks that were involved in this transaction. How do you get around the fact of the magnitude, even though a few ounces doesn't sound a lot, when you distill it to the terms of crack cocaine transactions, it's a heck of a lot of individual sized amounts. So how do you get beyond that problem?
Well, the government argues that as long as you have a quantity that can arguably be considered distribution quantities.
Well, aren't you talking about 1,000? I mean, I'm not too good on you know, drug quantities and how many hits, but I thought there was something in this record that talked about this being 1,000. Is that correct, or more?
I don't recall that testimony, Your Honor.
Okay, but we're talking about many, many sales that can be made from this quantity, are we not?
Well, it could be like ammunition. If people expect there to be a drought, they might want to, stockpile what they've got, but I think that 2.5 ounces of crack in a federal drug conspiracy is probably considered pretty small. And some might say that, well, this is something that is more of a street-level type of situation that the feds might not even get involved with because it doesn't really, hasn't gelled into what can be identified as a business, a conspiracy involving, you know, specialization of activities where there are some people work on the street, specific streets, and they've divided up their territories, and they've got specific people that supply them, and it's a business. When we're talking about 2.5 ounces of crack on 2 days, I'm not sure that would rise. Based on, you know, I've been doing this for over 20 years, federal drug cases, that's pretty small, Your Honor.
Well, maybe just because they don't target that amount doesn't mean that it isn't a distributable, or not just distributable, but intended for distribution when you deal in those amounts. Just because they go after bigger targets really isn't relevant, is it?
Well, I think it's looking at the argument that was made in the trial court about this being an inference piled upon an inference. The one inference being that the size, while it's small, arguably it could be a distribution amount that Mr. Folsom could not consume over a period of time, although I think there's no evidence that he couldn't consume that over the next month or two or week or two. And he admitted that he did use. But it's the inference on top of an inference that's relied upon by the government to say that they've proven their conspiracy at the Hill in Marion, and they've proven or presented evidence that in Asheville on May 17th and 18th, Mr. Folsom allegedly bought 2.5 ounces of crack from Mr. Allen, that they're connected by these inferences. The inference that the quantity itself shows that he was part of the conspiracy.
Well, they're entitled to prove it by circumstantial evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
You acknowledge that.
And, yes, Your Honor.
And you've been through that before. It's more of a jury question once they make a prima facie case, if they did, and you say they didn't. But that, but they did. I found it here on page 29. The government says that the court referred to the proof as being that there was over 1,000 street level rocks in crack.
Well, I would argue that even that's not necessarily an amount that will be distributed in the Hill-Marion conspiracy, where apparently, if you add up all the quantities involved, and
you can prove distribution by a large quantity, right? I mean, that's one of the factors that the jury's entitled to take into account.
As long as they don't just focus in on that fact and they look at the totality of circumstances,
right,
and the totality of those circumstances have been reviewed by the court to make sure that there's enough there that the jury isn't being called upon to speculate about a person's participation in this federal drug conspiracy. And I think that the inferences that were being used, the multiple inferences that were being used here, do take the jury into the realm of speculation.
Was there an instruction on separate conspiracy?
No, Your Honor.
Did you ask for one?
I don't recall trial counsel asking for a...
Why not?
Separate instruction
on... This is a perfect case to ask for an instruction on separate conspiracy. In other words, he's charged with this conspiracy alone, not another. And that's why you have the jury instruction on separate. Yeah, it may be a conspiracy as to here because the amounts are consistent with distribution, but there's no evidence. I think what you're arguing is that he's involved in this three-tiered drug. It seems to me that's critical in this case.
Well, the government seemed to argue that there were two conspiracies and that they could...
They argued there were two conspiracies?
I think...
Is that what you said?
That was my impression, that what they were saying was that that there could be just that conspiracy between Mr. Allen and Mr. Folsom and, I guess, Ms. Anderson, relating just to that quantity.
Even if the jury found that, he'd still be guilty of a conspiracy. You still have the same defense.
Well, I think that argument has problems in terms of the conspiracy requires two people to enter into the agreement. And I think to say that 2.5 ounces of crack buyer-seller relationship is really a conspiracy is kind of pushing it. But the bigger problem is the allegation in the indictment returned by the grand jury, and the defendant's entitled to have the grand jury decide what that accusation is, speaks in terms of the conspiracy centered on the hill in Marion, North Carolina. And so I think the bigger problem is the fact that the government was relying upon that conspiracy and trying to say that this transaction over here was inferentially connected over here because of one person, Mr. Folsom.
Well, that seems to me like the government wants to bite that off and try to prove that they can do it. It might have been simpler for it to try to do it the other way, to have not have had it so expansive.
Well,
they wanted to try to prove it that way. That was more, left you more openings to attack them on.
If
it comes up here, we have to look at it in the light most favorable to the verdict.
I think the court is called upon to look at all the facts and circumstances, including the arguments made by counsel in its closing argument, calling the jury to action. There is some posse type of argument to the jury about taking action and that this is a war on drugs. And the war was centered on
Were you saying that's an
hill.
Improper argument they made?
Well,
but you aren't raising an improper argument contention on appeal.
No, Your Honor.
Sufficiency of the
I
evidence.
Think in trying to understand how the jury could arrive at its conclusion, I think looking at the totality of the circumstances, both as to the prosecutor's screening of jurors that were not willing to go along with the government's witnesses, the shutting down of the defense in terms of exploring the benefits that these witnesses were receiving. And you have to keep in mind these witnesses are not the type of witnesses that appear in civil cases as experts who've completed high school, who've completed college, probably graduate degrees, and probably have a clean record criminally. We're talking about people who probably didn't go beyond ninth grade, who didn't go to work after they left the ninth grade, but went into lying, cheating, and stealing in order to support the life that they had become accustomed to. And for them to use the system, use the federal system to live that life, to hit people on the head with this testimony, I think the jurors should be allowed to hear an explanation of the circumstances, including the defense should be allowed to use expert testimony about how the system works. I mean, the government has used in the past expert testimony. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
You saved some time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it. Ms. Ray?
May it please the court. The defendant in this case received a fair trial in the district court in this case, as it stated. There was properly denied the motion for judgment of acquittal because there was substantial evidence that the defendant both knew of and participated in the charged conspiracy. This court has recognized that even a single transaction that is of sufficient quantity and there is enough to infer an intent to distribute can support a conspiracy charge. In this case, there was one conspiracy, and the defense did not request a multiple conspiracy instruction, but I don't think it would have succeeded even if they had, because the single conspiracy was in the hill. Now, Mr. Allen was a supplier to that conspiracy. He was a supplier to the second-tier distributor, and although he only supplied on two occasions, he supplied more than 1,000 doses, and the testimony that yields that amount is testimony, I believe it's on 524 of the joint appendix, that says in 3.5 grams you get 40 rocks. So they just extrapolated from what you get in an 8-ball and then multiplied that to 98 grams of crack that Mr. Allen distributed to Mr. Folston.
You said this was a hill in a conspiracy of drugs in the hill, you said?
Yes, sir.
What's the evidence that Mr. Allen knew that these drugs were going to be sold in the hill?
None at all, Your Honor. And we don't need that evidence, and this court's decisions make that very clear in Strickland. This defendant did not need to know the identity, where those drugs were going, or anything. What he needed to know was that he was dealing with an individual who was likely going to distribute those drugs, and Mr. Folston testified that he did distribute those drugs. The only way for the government to be able to get to the ultimate suppliers is to be able to, again, the conspiracy law recognizes this, the government doesn't have to prove that the person at the top knew the people at the bottom or even where the bottom was. And that would be an impossible burden to prove conspiracy if that were required, because the very nature as you go up the chain is no knowledge. They don't, you know, that Mr. Allen didn't want to know where his crack was going
to
be distributed.
Why do you think it's necessary to prove conspiracy? Don't you have evidence of distribution?
Yes, Your Honor, we did in this case. And I'm not saying that we had to have it to prove a conspiracy between Mr. Allen and Mr. Folston. We did not.
Right.
But we charged a conspiracy in the hill, and we proved that conspiracy. And so it was necessary for us to prove, and all I'm suggesting to Your Honor is this case law in this court, that this court has established in Strickland and Burgos and Reed and Banks, is that there is only knowledge necessary that you are dealing with one other member of the conspiracy and that there's an intent to distribute, and that you would the jury may infer that. And the government's evidence in this case was very strong. But because Mr. Folston was charged in a separate indictment, which was really sort of neither here nor there, but the government in this case proved the entire conspiracy in order to prove to the jury that not only did Mr. Allen engage in a conspiracy with Mr. Folston, but that was also part of the larger Hill conspiracy that was charged in this indictment.
The Hill is what, that area?
It's an area in Marion, Your Honor.
So, for example, if you had, hypothetically,
sure,
you have a brother-in-law who lives in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You live out in San Francisco. He comes out to visit you with your sister. He says, you know, I'm having a party back in New York and inviting a lot of friends in the Hamptons. You know, there's going to be a lot of people there, and I need to score about, you know, 1.5, 2 ounces, and that kind of thing. But clearly enough to have the 1,000 hits that Judge Keenan asked about of crack, for example. Maybe not the Hamptons, since it's crack. Maybe it's someplace else. But anyway, it turns out that the brother-in-law really is involved in a conspiracy of drug conspiracy in New York with a lot of people. So you're saying that merely the fact that you sold enough that was a distributable amount,
mm-hmm,
to this person without any knowledge other than the fact that he said, I'm having a big party in New York, you're part of the conspiracy that went on with the brother-in-law in New York?
Well, let me say this. The question would be whether it was reasonably inferable by the jury that the person in California was part of the conspiracy in New York. The defendant could make the argument in that case.
But he sold the drugs.
Right. And to answer your question directly, Judge Gregory, I think that's enough evidence. The jury could infer that the person in California, and I don't, it's not that I think it's enough evidence. This court's case has established that's enough. But the defendant in that case would have a much stronger argument to make to the jury that the jury shouldn't draw the inference that is permissible that defendant was part of the conspiracy, because in that case, the defendant would be able to say, if the defendant chose, you know, or maybe there was a witness there, hey, he told me it was part of this party. Now, a party where they were going to distribute 1,000 rocks of crack in one party is quite a party. Maybe that wouldn't be believed by the jury, but if it were, the jury might say, you know, this defendant didn't have any knowledge of that conspiracy and didn't plan to participate in it. But at a minimum, the defendant was in conspiracy with his brother-in-law, and that would be proven because the defendant gave 1,000 rocks of crack knowing the defendant was going to distribute.
The jury didn't have to find that all of them were involved in it, that you name in there. They just had to find that 2 or 3 were.
That's right, Your Honor.
Under that conspiracy law, I mean, it is broad. I mean, you could allege that all the people back in Columbia or wherever they made the stuff or brought it, started, were part of the conspiracy too, mm-hmm, but maybe they're unindicted yet or something.
Well, sure, and that's sort of the purpose of it, I think. If one goes back to why conspiracy law, why Congress drafted a law and why it's been interpreted to apply that broadly is because there is a reason that the government should be able to prosecute the person in Colombia. Who else do we want? I mean, we want to be able to reach those suppliers. It doesn't help the drug trade
in
Marion.
So the person in Colombia is a conspirator with the guy up on the hill.
That's right.
But they don't know each other.
Absolutely not. And there are spokes to conspiracies and all of that. But it doesn't help the community in Marion to take the street-level dealers off of the street and not address the suppliers. This was a four-tiered conspiracy. The government in this case, and I think the investigators, part of why Mr. Allen was charged later was because it took a while to start at the bottom and get up that far and find out who the other
suppliers. You only charged him with conspiracy.
We did.
Didn't charge him with any substantive offense.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I've had a conversation.
Pardon?
I've had a conversation with the prosecutor about whether that made the most sense in this case where you actually have, you know.
I wondered why you didn't.
You have discrete amounts.
Pretty cold on the distribution. Fence.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You had him pretty cold on.
Oh, yeah.
Did have him cold.
Right, and we had discrete amounts, and although Mr. Michael says this is a lot, this isn't a lot, well, it's still 1,000 rocks. And I note that the co-conspirators in this case were held responsible. Some of them, Mr. Wilkerson, Marquinez Wilkerson, for example, was held responsible for an amount of between 1.5 and 4.5 kilograms. So the quantity actually the defendant benefited by in terms of the government held him only responsible for the amount of drugs that he actually transacted. And the part of that recognition is the law that he was, even under conspiracy law, only responsible for what was reasonably foreseeable. The government didn't overreach in this case. The government didn't try to hold him responsible for everything that Mr. Folston distributed because we really recognized in this case that these were two discrete transactions, but they were in fact part of the broader conspiracy that took drugs from Buncombe County in Asheville to Marion. And that
how far is Marion?
It's about a half hour.
Which
in
county?
Fact, actually, I always know exactly when I'm a half hour from home because I live in Asheville when I hit exit 86, which is Marion.
So it's on I-40?
It's on I-40. It's right off I-40. That's right. It's a half hour away. They go down, and actually Mr. Folston lived in Old Fort, which was between Marion and Asheville. And so sort of right down I-40, you hit Old Fort right before you go down what we call Old Fort, or up if you're coming from Old Fort to Asheville, the Old Fort grade. So in this case, the evidence actually of the conspiracy and his participation in this one conspiracy was strong. The government acknowledges that it was only two transactions, but I note that they were on consecutive days. It wasn't, though, it was only one transaction. One transaction would have been enough under this court's case law. But here we had two, and the first one contemplated the second because it turned out that he was short, and the defendant said, well, the next time you need it, you know, I'll make it up to you. That next day happened to be the day that he made it up to him. So he knew that it was being distributed. Mr. Folston testified that it was distributed. If Your Honors don't have any further questions about the sufficiency of the evidence as to the conspiracy, I guess the only thing I would note about the fair trial issues is that the defendant in this case was given ample leeway and did, in fact, cross-examine carefully and vigorously on the questions of the benefits that the government witnesses gained in this case. Government witnesses were actually quite candid. Mr. Folston was very candid. And Ms. Anderson was never prosecuted. And so all that dispute about PSRs or 3553Es, 5Ks, didn't apply to her at all.
But he says you wouldn't give him the PSRs. There could be good information for him in those PSRs.
There could be, Your Honor, but the information in those PSRs is confidential, and the court strictly protects that confidentiality.
Well, if it helped the defendant get a fair trial, they ought to have that kind of material, I would think, wouldn't they?
Well, I would suggest this, that he got that
kind of... What if there's stuff in the PSR that he doesn't have otherwise? I mean, the inconsistent statements. What if he told the probation officer a different story than he told on the stand.
Well, Your Honor, that would suggest that they could just go on a fishing expedition. There's no evidence in this case that there was an inconsistent statement.
Well, they wouldn't know whether there's any evidence.
No.
Somebody looked at the PSR
right.
And certified to the judge or gave it to the judge to look at, and you made a record that there's nothing in this PSR.
That's
true. Impeaching or Brady material or exculpatory or anything. That wasn't done, was it?
Absolutely not. And this court's decision in Trevino.
Why wouldn't that do that? Why, well, it looks to me like that ought to be the way that things were operating.
Well, I would respectfully suggest that then
I agree with you on the conspiracy law, but I'm kind of in favor of giving the defendants a fair shot at these witnesses.
Well, I think that if that's the court's perspective, the court has to undo Trevino, and that would
well,
be quite
should.
The burden on the district courts to review every single.
Well, it's a burden on the district court and the prosecutor to give the defendant a fair trial. That's not a burden. That's your obligation. Both of you.
Agreed, Your Honor. Absolutely agreed. However, the defendant in this case, there has to be a burden on the defendant to at least know or have some idea that there is something in that PSR. That PSR contains.
How does the defendant know what the criminal record of these co-conspirators that you're putting on the witness stand might be when he's never met him? And you say he had never
right.
met him, and you couldn't prove he'd ever met him. He didn't have to know him. Under the law, he doesn't have to know who these co-conspirators are. His own co-conspirators doesn't have to know.
Right.
But he ought to know enough to be able to have a fair shot at cross-examining them and impeaching their credibility.
And he did. He knew.
Well, we don't know. We don't know what's in the PSR. We don't know whether he had all the felony convictions that they had.
In terms,
and every one of those could be impeaching.
In terms that he did have the record, he does know the defendants, what the defendants stood to gain. They were asked very specifically what they had to gain by testifying. And he was allowed extensive
deal. He knew what their deal was. You gave him the plea agreement. Is that what you did?
The plea agreement. Well, he was asked about it.
He doesn't know what he doesn't know what they told the probation officer. Whether they told the probation officer an inconsistent story, that would be impeaching.
Right, but he also
he doesn't know whether he has all the information as to their prior convictions, does he? Or does he?
I think he does know.
You certified that he had all the prior convictions of the witnesses. They all got felony convictions, so you got to turn those over.
Right. I mean, he knows the prior convictions. He knows the plea agreement. He's allowed to ask about that extensively. And the only thing that Your Honor has mentioned that maybe he doesn't know about is whether there was an inconsistent statement to the probation office.
If there's an inconsistent statement, he ought to be entitled to it.
Perhaps, Your Honor. But this court's case in Trevino requires that the defendant have some burden because the policy decision
But he doesn't know anything. How's he going to carry the burden?
Let me respond this way, Your Honor.
The burden shifts over to you all to give him a fair trial.
Right. But part of the reason, and a couple of things. First of all, the decision has been made right or wrong as a policy matter, and this court's decision in Trevino recognizes this, that pre-sentence reports contain a lot of private information, part of which, by the way, is co-conspirators and cooperators that could be very dangerous in the hands of defendants. That's why they're not always allowed access themselves, like to take him to prison, for example. But what matters in this case is they had discovery. If that witness had given inconsistent statements to anybody but the probation officer, they knew it. They had all of that.
That's the point.
Right.
If he gave an inconsistent statement to anybody but, they had it.
Right.
But what if he gave one to the probation officer? You're saying he wouldn't get it. Which might be the statement that turns the whole case.
Well, theoretically,
we've granted new trials where they turned up with prior inconsistent statements that should have been turned over and weren't.
Well, of course, but I'm not sure
that in the habeas corpus case.
You're absolutely, but I'm not sure that any of those were overturned because of a statement to a probation officer in preparation for a pre-sentence report. Those are inconsistent statements that were given after the crime, you know, they were never turned over because government counsel and prosecutors or agents didn't do their constitutional duty to turn them over. There is no constitutional duty to turn over a pre-sentence report of a witness, and it is dangerous to do so in some cases. It can put people's lives in danger.
I'm not talking about a pre-sentence report. I'm talking about what's in it that might be helpful to the defendant or that might be Brady material.
Well, okay.
Basically, or impeaching material.
If there is material,
if the government has impeachment information,
it has to turn
it's
it
supposed
over.
To provide it
sure.
to the defendant. That's what the Supreme Court said under Brady versus Maryland, and it's
and
progeny.
Jenks would be the case that requires that we turn over impeachment evidence. Absolutely. So if the government knew that the defendant had given a statement to the probation officer that was inconsistent,
you're
it would have a
that,
duty.
That the, an exception to all that is pre-sentence report, that the If there's Brady material in a pre-sentence report, you don't have to turn it over because the Trevino case says so.
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. First of all, there's no evidence in this case that there was Jinx material in any pre-sentence report of any of these witnesses. The government,
there is no evidence in it because nobody knows what's in them.
No, the government does, and presumably the government would have.
Well, did you certify to the court that there wasn't any, that there wasn't anything in it?
I haven't read every single one of the witnesses' pre-sentence reports. I cannot certify that to this court, but I will assume that had there been an inconsistent statement given by one of these testifying witnesses, it would have been turned over to the defendant, and the defendant hasn't suggested otherwise. But and I agree with Your Honor that these are sealed. The defendants don't have access to them. But what they did have access to, they were very ably able to make use of in this trial, and that was a lot. But there was really only one witness in this case, two, if you consider Nicholas Wilkerson, who was the witness that testified in the jail that he had a conversation with the defendant that was a little incriminating. But the only witness was Wilkerson that had a pre-sentence report. Anderson, and this whole case could have risen and fallen on Anderson. I mean, we could have relied, put her on the stand only, and we could have succeeded in proving Mr. Allen's connection to this conspiracy, and she didn't have a pre-sentence report because she wasn't prosecuted. And the defendant suggests that he didn't have the opportunity to ask about that, but that's flat wrong. If the court were to review Ms. Anderson's cross-examination, she was asked several times whether she was prosecuted. The only objection was sustained as asked and answered. It was not sustained because the court wasn't going to allow that question to be answered. It was asked. It was answered. She was asked repeatedly about various wrongdoings that she was not prosecuted.
Was she given immunity?
She was never charged.
Was she given immunity?
I have no idea.
Was she given vest pocket immunity? Was she told, I'm not going to be charged, just get up there and tell us?
I don't know that she did. What happened was there was a domestic violence, history of domestic violence between Ms. Anderson and Mr. Folston. She started cooperating because she was put in the hospital by him. She decided she would start cooperating against Mr. Folston.
Now, how much time did he get?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
How much time did he get? His sentence.
Mr. Folston or Mr. Allen? He got 120
Allen.
Months.
How many?
120 months, and the government agrees.
And you agree that needs to go back?
Yeah, absolutely. He was sentenced in February 2011.
And what did he be eligible for when he goes back?
It was 78, I've got it written down, 78 to 97 months was
the
guidelines.
So that's the new one that he's entitled to be considered under.
Trying to think about, I assume that at that point they would have calculated it based on the guidelines range that had been reduced under the Fair Sentencing Act. So the guidelines would have been applicable at that time, but the judges were not applying the lowered statutory ranges, even though I will note that the government, even in the district court in this case, asked the court to apply the lower ranges under the Fair Sentencing Act, because the government by then had agreed that the ranges in the act should apply. If Your Honors don't have any further questions, the government respectfully requests that you affirm the district court in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Mr. Michael?
About the confidentiality of the information in the PSI reports and the sentencing memorandums, the PSI reports, the same probation officer does everybody, basically has the same section for the offense conduct description that's used for everybody. So it's no big secret. And what's in Mr. Allen's offense conduct section probably is what is in all the other people's PSI report. So I'm not too certain why it's okay to show it to him afterwards, but not when he's in trial. Also, for over 5 years now, the prosecutor's office has been very diligent about protecting the confidentiality of the discovery it provides. And we have to not only be subject to local court orders maintaining confidentiality, we have to actually sign an agreement acknowledging those obligations and following specific procedures to maintain the confidentiality. I can't even give my client a copy of discovery to take back to the pod with them to look at. And quite frankly, that's probably a good idea. I don't believe in group decision-making on discovery back at the pod.
But this panel doesn't have any power to change the Trevino rule. I mean, all we could do would be criticize the way it's applied. So you can't tell us that we ought to change the rule, can you? We can't overrule another panel.
Yes, Your Honor. But because defense obviously didn't have this information to know of what was going on with the government, it's not just a matter of exculpatory information of one nature, but also of what is the difference between what the probation officer found to be the facts and what did they agree to be the facts. That's important. As to the Folsom transaction, that was an inference based upon the quantity. That was a distribution quantity. It was an inference that because Folsom was involved with one conspiracy, that this was involved with that conspiracy. It's just inference piled upon inference as to the connection between Mr. Allen and the conspiracy. And this is really industry-wide liability, like in the civil case where you got product liability, responsibility for everybody in the industry. That's what has been designed for the criminal justice system. And I don't think it's a good system. I don't think it's an accurate system. I don't think that it allows broad brushing of these cases, of going beyond the details, the facts of each transaction, and going into the nature of the transaction, which is, well, this involves crack. He sold crack. If the guy he sold to was involved with anybody else, then he's part of the conspiracy, whether this conspiracy was in one community or on the other side of this continent or on the other side of the world, he's liable. I just don't think that's a good system to have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. And I noticed that you're court-appointed, and we really appreciate your work in this case and other cases in which you've done the same thing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We couldn't operate without you.
Thank you.